Hey there, everybody. It is Wednesday, June 6th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. I am back from China as promised and just in time because we have a jam-packed show for you this week and we need to get started. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
That is a good thing. Let me introduce...
Unless we're on video, because, you know, I just can't tell anymore. I mean, my computer is looking at me, my phone is looking at me.
We're old school.
I'm in my apartment here in New York, and there are five live cams at every intersection.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, it's like, what's private anymore?
Well, we could talk about that.
I'm good to go, provided... We're not on video. If we're on video, I have to put some clothes on.
No, we are totally old school. It is just our voices, but I feel like I need to introduce you first, so let me do it. Tony Adams is a writer, editor, playwright, critic. He had previously been ordained as a Catholic priest, and after retiring from a subsequent 25-year career in community development, he began writing for the LGBT media and is currently found online and in print at Pride Magazine, The Mirror, 10,000couples.com, Queer New York Blog, blogspot.com and a ton of other places. In November of 2011, he wrote A Letter from the Bishop, which will have its first New York City reading in just a couple of days on June 11th. Tony Adams, not on video. Welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you, Ken. I am delighted to be here. And it's always a luxury to talk about what I'm doing because I'm used to interviewing other people, which I've done for the past couple of years, and it's been a great ride writing for the LGBT media. And then one day I wrote this play, quite literally in one day and a half.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, it was very strange. I sat down to do what I usually do, which is a 900-word article, sometimes about somebody else or about a topical issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I'm going to write about the fact that these bishops, these Catholic bishops, are insisting that their clergy read these letters from the pulpit, urging, not just urging, but ordering all Catholics to vote against some piece of legislation that proposes marriage equality.
Wow.
The bishops are playing politics.
Well, now, we probably need to back up a little bit, because let's set the stage and remind you that I'm a gay Jew from New Jersey. So my knowledge, we might have to use very simple terminology.
I was going to ask you if you were raised Catholic, because that does make a difference.
Very much. So pulpit, that's a type of juice. Again, we need to back up a couple steps.
So pulpit is the thing that... that you hold on to when you're preaching. You preach at the pulpit.
Yes.
It's usually got a microphone on it, and it's like a stand. It'll hold your notes or your speech or your sermon or your Bible or whatever.
All right.
So when I say that the bishop ordered all his priests, and this has happened repeatedly all over the country, to read a letter from the pulpit, that means in church on Sunday, every priest of his diocese, which is his jurisdiction,
yes,
will have to read a letter instructing, ordering all Catholics in that diocese to vote against whatever legislation has been proposed that would allow same-sex marriage.
And what are your options as someone in that diocese for saying, you know what, I actually would like to read a letter from Dear Abby this week, and I'm going to skip that.
You really don't have an option. And that is the meat of the play, because, you know, I know people that have refused that sort of thing. A friend of mine, Jeffrey Farrow, who was a priest in California, refused, and he got booted out.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and at the time, it really angered me that all the gay priests in his diocese didn't stand up with him and say, you know what? We don't agree with this either, and
right,
we're going to stand with Jeff, and they didn't. And it really galled me, because I don't know, you know, I think the biggest secret of the Catholic Church is the fact that most of the Catholic priests are gay.
Hmm.
It's just like the presumption is that I think in many, in the minds of many straight Catholics is, father has given up marriage to a woman. He's given up being a father to his own family of children and being married to a woman. And that is why we must honor father and we must respect him because
right.
he gives that up for us. When if they knew that most of their priests were gay and that the good-looking ones or the ones that have an active sex life are out at the bars locally.
Yeah.
Or they're at the gym picking people up, or they're at a rest stop picking people up, or they're online, as happens nowadays.
Right.
I think they would be very surprised and shocked. You know, if you talk to gay guys, they'll tell you, oh, God, yeah, I knew so many gay priests, and I always used to see them out and about. It's not shocking to the gay community. It's shocking, I think, to the Catholic in the pew.
Yeah. And then there are those who we should do a little bit of word of caution and encourage these priests to maybe take their collar off for their Grindr pictures. Just maybe some more.
I think they do. Although, to that point, I have to say, last summer I'm coming back from a week in Provincetown. And I took the Megabus. I'm headed back to Manhattan, and I got a ride to Providence, Rhode Island, and I'm at the bus stop waiting to get the Megabus back to Manhattan. And there's an older woman, I guess she was in her 60s or so, she's looking at me, and, you know, a week in Provincetown, I'm wearing cutoffs, I got flip-flops on, I got a little hat on, and a T-shirt and everything, and she says to me, "You're a priest, aren't you?" I said, "How did you do that?
Wow.
How did you know?" And she said, "I just knew it."
Look at that.
You know, whether you keep your collar on or not, there's, she turned out to be a nun from the Upper West Side here in Manhattan. And we had a great time. The bus was 3 hours late, and we talked and talked and talked, and it went like 5 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
And while I'm on the subject of nuns, I don't know if you've been following the fact that the Vatican
I have.
Has come down hard on the American nuns.
On the bad nuns.
Oh, my goodness. They are. It's just ridiculous. You know, these women give their lives to the Catholic Church, accept second-rate status, do everything they can, but they're not allowed to do the sacraments. They're not allowed to hear confession or say Mass. But they have been the backbone of the Church, long-suffering, overworked, underrated. And now the Vatican has the nerve to say, you know, you girls, you need to rein yourselves in.
Right.
I mean, it's almost the last gasp.
Now, Tony, I can oversimplify this because, again, I'm a gay Jew from New Jersey, so what do I know? And you were a Catholic priest. But
I am a Catholic priest.
You are a Catholic priest.
Oddly, I have never been suspended.
Oh, well, we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
But isn't the religion centered on being as good to each other as possible?
Of course. That is the basis of the Christian message.
So how do we then yell at the bad nuns?
Well, you know, these ladies have gotten themselves an education. And,
right.
And Catholics in general in the Western world have become educated. They are not impressed with smoke and mirrors anymore. They are not impressed with imperial dictates anymore. They have been told, you must form the birth control thing was very interesting because although the Vatican said birth control is bad, the American Catholic woman, anxiety-ridden over this whole issue, went into the confessional where most of the priests in America said to the Catholic woman, look, pray over the issue, form your conscience, and then do what you think is right. In other words, don't sweat it.
Right.
And these women learned that the basic law of the Church is compassion.
Right.
And that what a bishop says is not necessarily what is going to get you into heaven. And the instant that premise was set, I think we finally had a generation of, I'm sure you can hear that background noise.
Well, I'm a little nervous. It's the Vatican sending people after you.
Yeah, it is. And you know, they're long overdue, given the fact that I'm now married and everything. But anyway, my point is that we are now at a point in the Catholic Church in the United States where empathics are thinking people, and they're saying, no, I don't buy what that bishop is saying.
Right.
I don't buy what that pope is saying. The law of compassion, you know, the parables of Jesus, that's the only reason that I love Jesus, is everything he said holds true.
Right.
The church screwed it all up over the centuries, but the basic teaching of Jesus, you can open the New Testament to any one of the Gospels, and whenever they talk about Jesus said this or Jesus told this story, it holds true perfectly.
Right.
It just got screwed up over the centuries when the church became a club, an organization.
Well, we've been really fortunate over the past 4 years to have many reverends on the show, and one of the most interesting topics, if you're willing, is to talk a little bit about your calling, because having someone who espouses both an LGBT sexual orientation and a faith background, although it shouldn't be a conflict, we run into so many times in society where it is. So can you talk a little bit about what led you down that path?
Well, I was 14 years old, and my best friend said, let's go look at the seminary. So we did. And it was wonderful. I loved it. It was a big Gothic building. You had your own room, and I had two younger brothers. We didn't have our own rooms. And I realized that even at 14, wow, these are my people. This
right.
is my tribe. And when I went into the seminary, and I was the youngest of 650 students, age 14 to, I think, like 21, I thought, oh, my God, everyone here is gay.
Mm.
And this is like heaven. This is wonderful. And the premise is that we just don't talk about it.
Right.
We'll all be gay. We'll put on musicals 6 times a year. You know, in the first year in the seminary, they had me sing the Maria part in this Do Re Mi.
In Sound of Music, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, they like me. And I can prosper here. And over the years, you know, I got a really good education. Then they sent me to Rome, and it was, I knew that I had a place in the church, that my sense of performance was something that was useful. I worked in the Vatican in the ceremonies department.
Wow.
As an assistant master of ceremony in 1975, because the Pope's master of ceremonies liked me and thought I did a good job, and I was helpful. And it was, I had found my place in the church, so that is not a typical vocation. But when I came back and did parish work and realized the importance of showing up at 3 a.m. in a hospital when somebody is dying and the family wants you to do an anointing or hear a last confession, and I thought, wow, this is the real stuff, and I'm glad I did this, because all those nights that I spent out cruising the bars and everything, I thought, you know, I'm justified by doing what needs to be done for people in need. So for me, it was a very interesting balance of having a gay life and also being present and in service to Catholics when they needed to do that.
Now, what kind of responses? I would love to just fast forward even to finding a partner and telling people and getting out there and dating. I would imagine that there were some people who, when you told them what you did, thought that, well, is he talking about a drag show? Is he being serious? And then realized, no, this is indeed what he does for a living.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I met my the person who is now my husband, and when we met 28, almost 29 years ago, it was in a bar, and I didn't tell him my background until, I think, about a month later, shortly before he moved in with me. And then also when I needed to get a new career, I soft settled it. I didn't want anybody to know, because it was so, people in those days, it was weighted heavily with, you know, oh my God, this guy is an ex-priest, or this guy is a priest, or, you know. It was just a larger issue than I wanted to deal with. I ran from it, basically. And I just didn't talk about it. And now, safely distanced by all these years, I woke up one morning in November and said, this is why I was ordained. I was ordained to write this play. Pope ordained to talk about the Catholic priest and the bishop and to rectify the damage that is being done to the Catholic Church. People say, do you hate the Church? And the answer is no, I do not hate the Catholic Church. I want it back. It's been screwed up by these bishops.
Right.
It's been screwed up by this Pope.
Right.
And it is, in essence, a wonderful thing. You know, people want to make sense out of the universe. They want to make sense out of their life. Everything that Jesus said, all his stories, all his parables, those are all you need to guide you through life. But religion, that everything's screwed up.
Yeah.
And if I do anything right, and I'll know it if it's right, somebody will say to me, you know, I went to your play, and for the first time I understood I don't need to feel guilty about who I am and how I feel.
Right.
Whenever that happens, and it's happened in the past and because of a number of things that I've written, but I hope the play does that. I hope the play was written by me for the good of the Church. I don't want to skewer the Church. I don't want to attack the bishops. God knows I know enough number of bishops and cardinals whom I like.
Yeah. There's some good ones.
And some I've had sex with.
And then there's that.
And then there's that, too. So, but it's the duplicity and the dishonesty and the phoniness and the pretense that I think needs to go.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm not out to shock the Catholic in the pew, although they may be shocked a little bit by the first scene in the play in which three priests are talking very candidly with each other about their life. But the play swiftly moves into what happens when one priest decides he's not going to, he doesn't want to read that letter that
right.
the bishop is saying that they all have to read. And you have the other two priests. One is a classic queen priest. Everyone loves him. He's the kind of guy you trust your kids with, but he's very effeminate and he's funny. He's you know, just that way.
Yeah.
But you love him. And he doesn't know what to do. He's all worried. And then you get the third priest, who is played by Will Clark, incidentally, who is guest on your
Our show. Good buddy, Will Clark.
We love Will Clark. And what an interesting aspect of casting that is to have somebody who had Will Clark's career in the adult film business as playing one of the priests. But he plays the priest who likes everything just as it is. He's the heartbreaker priest who will go home with you. You'll have an incredible hot night with him. And he'll never call you again because, you know what, he's going out next Friday. He wants to see what else is there. He likes everything just the way it is. And the lead part, played by Ken Averett, who originated the role when I had the reading in Fort Lauderdale, this part, Father Ed, he's the guy who's conflicted.
Hmm.
He wants love, and he doesn't want to be phony, and he doesn't like the double standard. He doesn't want to live the lie. And so this is about his struggle. And there's a confrontation, which should knock your socks off.
Oh, boy.
Between him and the bishop. And then the play becomes, in some ways, a will he or won't he. And in the end, you see how each one of these priests deals with the order from the bishop to read the letter, and I think there'll be some surprises.
Very exciting. And as I said at the top of the show, first New York City reading in just a couple of days.
Yes, it's at Monday, June 11th, 7 p.m. I don't know how to talk about the availability of tickets. Here's what I've figured I should say to you.
Okay.
Most of the theater is reserved. It's an off-Broadway theater. Having said that, there are still some seats available, very few. And let's assume that not everybody who reserved a seat will come. So if there are any of your listeners who are going to be in New York or could be in New York on Monday, there's a website you can go to find out. You can reach me, actually, and I can tell you what your chances are of getting seats. And I would hate to discourage anyone from being there just because we have mostly reserved every seat. But there is some availability. You can go to a letter from the bishop.blogspot.com.
Perfect. Perfect. Now,
or you can email me at a letter from the bishop at me.com, md.com.
Now, if I were to just stand outside the theater with my Will Clark T-shirt holding a Will Clark I Love You sign, that's fine, though, right?
Who could say no to that?
Well, I'm hoping not Will. That's the whole point, Tony.
Let me just tell you something about Will Clark, since you know him. When Will auditioned to do this reading, I was, of course, very delighted given his background, and because I thought he'd be very suitable. I needed somebody who looked hot and looked sexy. But when Will read, and I heard him deliver this part, I was amazed, and I realized how much a legitimate actor forfeits some of his life possibilities when he does adult films.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked about this with Will, but all the while I was reading, I was thinking, geez, this guy is a really good actor.
Oh.
And I bet he's been denied a lot of possibilities because he chose to go that route.
Not on my show, Tony. Not on my show.
Yeah, it's too bad. But when people see what he does with this part, oh, my God, he is so good. As is Jimmy Moon as the Queenie sort of funny, lovable priest, Father John, as is Ken Averett, who gave up an acting career to move to Fort Lauderdale. He has the lead as Father Ed, the conflicted priest. He's just incredibly
so
good.
Exciting.
I'm so grateful for my cast. And Dean Resch plays the bishop. Dean Resch writes for Gay City News here in New York and also has an acting background. And he walked in and scared me to death because he was very upset. And I thought we were doing the audition. I said, Dean, do you not want to do this audition now? And what he had done was he went into character as the bishop already.
Look at that.
He sat down and just read it, and he was just too wonderful.
It's method acting right there.
Yeah, it is. And both Ken Averett and Dean Resch come from the same method acting school. So they're both like that.
Well, you got some pedigree. You got some pedigree there. Well,
I am so honored by this, by my whole cast. So Monday, 7 p.m., St. Clement's Theater, 423 West 46th Street.
So exciting. Now, we do have to talk about your musical selections real quick before we let you go, because you called the music for this week's episode.
I'm delighted that you asked me.
Well, I love this gives us a little insight. This is the part of the show, Tony Adams, where we ask our guests to give us a little self-analysis about what some of their song selections say about them.
Oh, I didn't know I would have to do that.
It's kind of the surprise. It's better if we don't tell you. Yours makes it a little bit more fun because yours is all about lost divas. And
yes.
I'm curious what this reflects you think about you. We have to have you talk about one of them because, I was in China when she passed away and I haven't been able to talk about it.
Which is why when you asked me to pick those, that came to my mind.
Oh, my gosh. So, I mean, for folks who...
Donna Summer.
Yes, for folks who...
We lost the great Donna Summer.
We lost Donna. And Donna Summer and one of the Bee Gees in the same week. It was quite a bad week for disco.
It really was. But Donna Summer, I think, defined so much of our social life.
Yeah.
I don't know how old you are, Ken, but, you know, I'm, I hate to say it, but 60. And so from the time I came out and going out and everything, Donna Summer defined my experience of social life as a gay man. And I can't hear, as cliched as it is, when I hear Last Dance, you know, I go back to every night I ever spent in Provincetown or in New York, where that was the last song of the evening. But I chose State of Independence, her cover of that, which I think is not too well known.
I don't know that one.
Absolutely superb.
Well, this is very exciting.
You have to play it.
We're going to play it. That's what's going to play this interview out. And we got Cass Elliott, and we'll have Karen Carpenter a little bit later. Do you know that in 4 years of this show, I don't think we've ever played Cass Elliott or Karen Carpenter of This Show Is So Gay?
Well, shame on you.
I know. But we're rectifying it right now. We're going to rectify that right now.
And I picked Cass's song, Make Your Own Kind of Music, I think is what I chose.
Yes.
Yeah. Because it's sort of, you know, the thing that we sang as seminarians when we would lip sync to the Mamas and Papas, mm-hmm. which we did a lot in our dormitory.
Of course you did.
When we weren't fighting over who was going to lip-sync Diana Ross when we did the Supremes. And I would have killed anyone that didn't let me take the lead in that adventure. But Cass Elliot was, I don't know, we all loved her, and Too Soon Departed.
So oh,
I went
yeah.
from the Too Soon Departed Donna Summer to three other Too Soon Departed.
Absolutely.
And of course, Karen Carpenter. And I chose Ticket to Ride because, you know, that song was a flop when it was first released, her cover of it. But eventually, it gained a following.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favorites.
And then, of course, one of my personal favorites, and she's also gone, Laura Nyro.
Yeah.
And a very obscure song by her that I just particularly love, Triple Goddess Twilight. So I'm just delighted that you're going to play any of it.
A good selection for this week's show. But yeah, no, that Donna Summer news hurt me pretty bad when I read about that. And I have to say, Mama Cass, when they used to make, I don't know if they still make them, but those VH1 Behind the Musics, have you seen those? Oh my gosh, the Mamas and the Papas, there was some drama.
Oh, big time.
Some drama.
Big time.
The Mamas
big
and the Papas, so, and the Carpenters, too. So, very exciting stuff, and we'll play all that. Well, I must say, these are going to be a very exciting next couple days for you, I would imagine.
We are doing rehearsals starting tomorrow and running all weekend, and then we have the theater from 10 a.m., so we'll do the dress rehearsals. And, you know, we're doing what is called a staged reading, where you don't just sit there and read from the script, but there's some stage action. There'll be some costuming, there'll be some movement, so the people that go to this will see everything close to an actual production. And of course, the purpose for a reading is to get feedback, and also to attract people that might want to produce the play. So everybody who made a reservation has my email, as do you now as well, and anybody who goes can please feel free to tell me, you know, I like this, I didn't get that, or this was wrong, or whatever. The first reading I had in Fort Lauderdale, the feedback was very, very helpful. And I'm looking forward to the same. I hope everyone likes it. Everyone finds it entertaining as well as topical.
But you're giving people something to talk about, and I think that that's just so important. This isn't a piece of fluff, even as I have no doubt it is extraordinarily entertaining. But you're giving a voice to a lot of folks who have experienced that conflict or who want to explore their faith more, but have run into a little bit of a wall. And
you're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
To give them the medium to do that,
it's great.
Yeah, tell me.
I look at two things. I knew that it was a heartfelt writing for me, that I wrote it from the heart, and that it spilled out. And I had that experience that writers sometimes talk about, auto writing, where the words just simply come out and you almost just channel them. And so I knew it was authentic, and I knew it was fine. I knew that part was good. But I didn't know how good the words would be in terms of a play.
Right. Right.
And I still don't know that. You know, the person who writes is the last one to be able to critique it in terms of a piece of art, in terms of a piece of writing. So, you know, I've been very lucky. Great writers like Wally Lamb have read the script and were very helpful with me and have been very encouraging and said, you know, that's good. So, I've been encouraged by that, but we won't know until the end of time whether or not I've written anything really good.
Or you'll know on Monday.
We'll know on Monday, yes. And I wish you weren't going to be here.
Do me a favor, and if you wouldn't mind, because perhaps it would grease the wheels for me possibly going on Monday, if you could just subtly ask Will Clark if he could just give me a one-night reprieve on the restraining order, I could possibly go. But right now, unfortunately, I have to keep my distance from the theater, given that he would be in it. The play is called A Letter from the Bishop. It is having its New York City premiere this Monday. Tony Adams, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Can't wait to hear the feedback.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's been delightful.
All the best, Tony.
You too, babe.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
right, folks, and we are back, and we're joined by our favorite lawyer, new media expert, LGBT leader, diversity advocate, commentator, and motivational speaker of all of those things, Jimmy Nguyen. Welcome back to this show, Is So Gay.
Thanks, Ken, and welcome back from China.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Now, we have to get this out of the way first, Jimmy. With your appearance right this second on This Show Is So Gay, you have tied singer-songwriter Eric Hyman for the most appearances on our show, and you did it in record time. How does that make
you? Holy
moly. I know. How does that make you feel?
Well, it confirms my Asian overachiever status from childhood, and makes me feel that I should go learn the cello now.
Oh, how's your math?
My math is excellent, actually.
All right.
In fact, I was always ironically better in math than and science courses in school than other, like, language and political or social sciences, even though I practice law for a living.
Nice.
But I can do math like there's nobody's business.
All right.
I'm doing some calculus right now in my head as I'm talking to you.
I find that that makes the show go faster. I find
right.
that many
Even
of our listeners
advocate,
do that.
I'm doing it without an abacus.
Well, we are here today to talk about your latest op-ed entitled "Our Organizations Must Avoid Debates on Non-LGBT Issues." Now, I know this was posted a few weeks ago, but again, I've been in China. So there's so much I want to talk about this piece. But first, why don't you start out and give everyone a synopsis and what led you to write this?
Sure. This piece actually originated, as many things do in the gay community, at the gay gym.
Nice.
So, not exactly a gay gym, but I work at this gym in West Hollywood, I know, prototypical, that where a lot of fellow lawyers that I know in the entertainment and media industries work, and one of them, who is a lawyer at an unnamed film studio, came up to me one day at the gym and said, "Did you happen to see this email that the Stonewall Democratic Club sent out in Los Angeles, sent out to its followers and supporters?" And I said, "No, what are you talking about?" And this was right in the midst of the heated debate over the SOPA and PIPA legislation, which deals with internet piracy,
right.
Which the entertainment industry a number of months ago was trying to get Congress to pass to give it new tools to fight the piracy of its content on the internet. And so as a lawyer, I've been following that, and he said to me, this email went around, I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, they're encouraging their members to call Congress people to vote no on SOPA and PIPA." And he had two reactions. One is, well, why is this gay political group getting involved in a SOPA and PIPA debate?
Right.
And two, you know, don't they realize they're asking people to take a position against an industry that employs a lot of LGBT people?
Yeah.
And I said, that's really interesting. So it got me thinking that might be worth talking about. And so that's why I wrote this piece for The Advocate. And the crux of it isn't that LGBT organizations should never take positions on issues that are not what I would consider gay issues. And, you know, there's can be a debate about what that means, you know,
right.
what are LGBT issues. But things that do not directly impact the LGBT community. And that's the point of it, is that I think those instances should be rare, when an LGBT organization, either a civil rights or political group, should use its resources, time, and effort to take a public position on issues that do not directly affect the LGBT community. And the reason I think that is because I'm being a pragmatist. Mm-hmm. In the ideal world, it would be absolutely wonderful, Ken, if everyone wanted to hear the LGBT community's opinions about any issue, no matter what it was.
Right.
But at this stage of the LGBT movement, I just feel that we spend a lot of time and effort, those of us who are involved with LGBT organizations, to raise money. And as you know from a prior conversation we had on your show, only 3% of LGBT adults give money to the major national LGBT organizations.
Which isn't a very big number.
Which is not a very big number. And so given the limited resources the LGBT political and civil rights groups have, I just feel that they should concentrate their efforts and their resources on issues that are more core to the LGBT community. And one day, maybe they will be flooded with resources. Maybe one day we'll have achieved most of the LGBT community's goals in the political spectrum, and we can start advocating for lots of other issues. I just think until that day comes, that we should conserve our resources, And instead of diluting our voice into other issues, focus them on the issues which more directly affect our LGBT community.
About a month ago, two months ago, on another segment of the show, I had some sort of rant because there was an article. I can barely remember the specifics. I can just remember the rant. The rant was about how is it that we have some of these dialogues on the national level about issues other than the fact that we don't have full equality. Because I took your article and I ran with it a little bit and perhaps ran a little bit too far. But when I was looking at, okay, so we're talking about SOPA and PIPA, I get nervous that someone reads that an LGBT organization endorsed this stance and even for a second they're able to forget that on the basic human rights level that we don't have equal rights.
You know, and that is a different angle that I did not think of. Thank you very much for pointing that out. I think that
I'm here to help.
I think that is an important thing to consider. I think that goes to my point of being careful about not diluting
right.
the voice of the LGBT community, which doesn't mean, as some of the detractors who posted comments to the article were voicing, you know, the flip side and opinion I kept hearing from the comments was, well, we are human beings as LGBT people. We live in a greater society. We need to care about all issues. And
yeah.
I say to them, absolutely.
Absolutely.
You're absolutely correct that each of us as individuals should care about whatever issue we want to care about and voice our opinions about them. I'm talking about where we devote the resources of the organizations that some 3% of us only fund, right?
Right.
And where to use that political voice. So one of the other examples I gave was when GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation in 2011, initially supported the proposed merger between AT&T and T-Mobile. And it also weighed in on the net neutrality debate that was going on by sending a letter to the Federal Communications Commission opposing
mm-hmm.
it. And then reversed course on those things when there was a lot of controversy over whether or not GLAAD should be getting involved on those issues. And I can see that there are some arguments that things such as a freer internet cultivates more opportunity for information for LGBT youth. I can see that. But I just think that in the core of what LGBT organizations do, that should not be the top of the agenda.
Right.
And if they had unlimited resources, I'd say, great, go to town, advocate on lots of different issues. But then it forces a choice, which is another point I made in this piece, which is, well, how does an LGBT organization decide what position to take on issues that less directly affect the LGBT community? Because all people in the gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender community don't agree on everything.
Right.
Right? We mostly agree on LGBT issues, though not always, right? Such as, for example, during, you know, the aftermath of Prop 8 here in California, we didn't all agree about whether we should go back to the ballot box and try to repeal Prop 8 or wait for a court decision in the Prop 8 battles. So we don't always agree. We don't agree all the time about whether transgender rights should be put into pieces of legislation that are advanced on behalf of the LGBT community. So if we can't agree on those things, I was wondering, well, why should an LGBT political or civil rights group be taking positions on more mainstream issues that don't uniquely affect us? How are we ever going to reach agreement on that? Not that they have to, but I just found that it created the concern that there was some gay voice to SOPA and PIPA or net neutrality, for example, or whatever the issue, you name it. And there, I don't think there is a single LGBT voice on those issues or opinion. And I think it is detracting for an organization to devote its resources to taking a public position on that when it's not necessary.
But not just detracting from resources. One of the commenters on advocate.com made an allusion to that if these organizations are using their donations for non-LGBT causes, it feels disingenuous. That's not necessarily what folks are giving their money towards. And so I know that you have the fundraising side to your brain as well. Is there a sense of irresponsibility there? If an LGBT organization that is soliciting funds based on marriage equality, or, you know, I was saying that when President Obama made his comments on ABC News, within, and I'm sure you had the same experience, within a few minutes, I had 5-6 fundraising appeals from various organizations. Now, none of those appeals said, by the way, there are some non-LGBT issues we might use your money towards.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I don't know that I'd go so far as to say it's disingenuous. I think you're correct that most fundraising in today's day and age by LGBT organizations are focused on using the marriage equality issue to get people out to donate money. Or, you know, anti-bullying efforts, for example, right?
Right.
Those are the topics du jour that motivate people emotionally to give money. And I think, as someone who has been on the board of an organization that's had to raise money and who gives money myself, I would feel a little bit bothered by the fact that an organization would take positions on issues that are not really the reason I gave money to them.
Right.
Which isn't to say that these organizations should be handcuffed, right, and not make judgment calls about when to take positions.
Right.
As I said in my op-ed piece, certainly there are situations where we have to stand with other minority groups, like racial minority groups.
Absolutely.
That are common to all of us. Certainly we need to use our organization's money to support straight political allies in their election campaigns, right? Because they will in turn help us. So there's definitely reasons for it. I just believe that when it comes to taking a stance on a political or legislative issue that doesn't directly affect us, those situations should be rare and much more carefully thought out. And I'm not suggesting the organizations who took these positions didn't carefully think them out. I just question. My opinion is that I disagree that they did that, and I think we should do that as a community much less often until we achieve our primary LGBT goals. I'm also totally open to the fact that people disagree. I just was actually quite tickled.
Tickled because we love the comments.
I know. I just find it interesting that the people who post the negative comments do so with such vitriol.
Yes.
Which isn't to say they can't disagree. Totally. I can see how people would disagree with me. There was just on both The Advocate and this piece also ran on Queerty and on SDGLN.com. There were some pretty, scathing comments. And I'm, I've got a thick skin. I'm totally prepared for it. I wouldn't put out pieces unless I was prepared for criticism.
Right.
I just wish that people would open their mind more to the thought provocation I'm trying to inject, which is, should the money that you give be used for issues that don't directly affect our community?
Right. It's so interesting. I ran again. I was in China when I was reading this piece, and I was actually really struggling to find a sense of gay community in the area of China that I was in. So I'm trying to frame my mind in this because I know that I actually, as I'm thinking about it more now, ran so far with your op-ed that I immediately went to yes, and I'm annoyed that some of our national LGBT press, our once a month glossy magazines that will go unnamed, but reference being out of the closet, so habitually feature straight allies, of course, on their covers, as if to say, okay, so we're paying money for the subscription. Can we not find 12 gay people for the 12 issues of the year to be featured on the cover? I'm telling you, I really ran with your piece.
Oh, well, I'm glad you liked it. I don't necessarily have to assume that you and other people agree with it. I think it's just an important conversation to have in our community at a time where there's so much to accomplish for
right.
LGBT rights and not enough dollars to go around. If you talk to any LGBT organization, they're going to tell you
cash-strapped.
They need more money.
Yeah.
They're cash strapped. You know, I and people like you probably are on all these email lists where we're constantly getting hit up for money.
Yeah.
And I find it frustrating that our money then, when we give it, might be used for things that we think are peripheral or secondary.
Right.
I'm not saying that the issues aren't important and that individual LGBT people shouldn't have opinions upon them. And if you want to go support or efforts to stop anti-piracy legislation, go for it. Call your congressperson, right? I just wanted to raise for the community's consideration whether or not our hard, collected organization resources should be devoted to that end. It's not an absolute no, but I think it should be, at this time, rare.
Let's take the next step then. So you are on a board, and what you're putting out there is that we need to have priorities because we have limited resources. How should some of these organizations really suss out what their priorities should be from their membership? Because I have to say, I haven't taken, and now I know surveys sometimes annoy me, but I haven't taken one in a while. I have not been asked in quite some time what my priorities are. So again, if I were to find out that my hard-earned dollars are being used for something I felt was kind of peripheral, that might annoy me a bit.
True. And I think the first thing an organization has to ask itself is, what is my core mission?
Right.
What are my strategic objectives for this year and for the forthcoming years, so that I can answer to my constituency that I am doing what I said I set out to do, and I'm using your money and resources to do it. And if an issue does not, or a candidate or elected official, you know, support of them doesn't directly affect that core mission, I think the organization should think twice, three times, four times before taking a public stance on that issue or with respect to a particular candidate or official. There was a good point made by some commenters that, for example, the Stonewall Democratic Club is not just limited to LGBT causes. It's a democratic, you know, group of people.
Right.
And I think they probably have a little bit more leeway, from my view, to take on other causes. But still, their unique identifier is that it's an LGBT democratic club.
Right.
Right. And so I still think, you know, organizations like that should be more cautious given the resource issue. So I think the first step is to ask, what's our core mission? What are our strategic objectives for this year and for upcoming years? And does taking a public stance on this advance those? If it doesn't, then I wouldn't do it.
There you go. There you go. Hey, can you put on your lawyer hat for a second? Because I know that just today, some big news out of your home state there in California about the court rehearing Prop 8. What does this mean for the gay community?
So what it means is there will be at least more certainty as to the timeline by which the Prop 8 case that's in the federal courts will have a final resolution. So at this point, so what it means is the current Ninth Circuit decision that struck down Prop 8 will stand for the time being. There's still a stay of the ruling so that people can't run and get married in California right now. The proponents of Proposition 8 now have 90 days to decide whether to file a petition to the U.S. Supreme Court to seek review of the decision, to basically say, hey, Supreme Court, we want you to hear this case.
Right.
And so if they do file that, as many people expect them to do, then the Supreme Court then has to decide whether it grants review, because the Supreme Court doesn't have to hear every case that's that people ask it to. They get to choose. So then we would know within some period of time, probably later this year, by the end of the year, whether it would take the case for hearing. And then if it does take the case for hearing, then it's likely we would get a hearing and then ultimately decision on the case sometime next summer.
All right.
So it would give some certainty as to the timeline. So a lot of people are excited about it because many people thought the Ninth Circuit would at least grant en banc review, which is a review by a fuller panel of judges, not just the three that heard the first, initial appeal. And that would have delayed things a little bit further. But, we'll know probably by October whether the Supreme Court hears it or not, assuming the proponents seek review, which many people expect they will. And then if the Supreme Court does take on the case, you could have a decision by next June. Interestingly, it also would come at a time where the Supreme Court, could be hearing a challenge to DOMA.
Yeah.
Right? As well, because of the recent First Circuit opinion out of Boston, which struck down DOMA as unconstitutional.
I know all these things happen when I was in China.
Well, because the universe spins faster in the LGBT movement when Ken is in China.
I would like to believe that that's not true, but I'm looking at the news right now, and a lot happened while I was gone, so I'm going to put that theory out there.
I actually think it's clearly not about you just being in China. I think we are at this interesting sort of funnel point in the LGBT movement. There have been all these efforts by many different organizations over the last few years to bring these cases, to raise awareness of LGBT issues. There's been a lot of media coverage, and there's been this increased groundswell of public support.
Right.
And because of that, more cases on the legal end in courts are being pushed, and they're just coming to fruition, right? And so I feel like it's like everything is, getting pushed and funneled to this point where maybe we're going to finally break through a logjam of a lot of different barriers. And that's a great thing, and I think that's because of the efforts of a lot of great organizations who should focus on their core mission and use the resources that they get from donors to fight these causes.
Look what you did there. You brought it full circle around. That was very good.
I'm good at the bookend.
You're good at the bookend. Well, put on your fundraiser hat. By the way, my goal is to get you to put on all these different hats, and then you're going to have some sort of Sybil.
I wear a lot of hats.
I know, but I think I could get you to have some sort of Sybil-type break on the show if we keep switching from personality to personality. We're going to see what happens. Put on your fundraising hat and give everyone good news, because we love good news. Last time you were on, you and Liesl talked about the It Gets Better musical project, and you were asking people for money, and you had this bold fundraising campaign and a big old target. What happened?
So we have great news. So yes, that was Liesl Reinhardt, my esteemed partner in many things in life and in creativity, and I were pitching people for money to donate on Kickstarter.com. We use online crowdfunding resources to try and raise $75,000 to fund development of a theater project based upon the It Gets Better campaign done with the Gay Men's Chorus of LA. And the great news is we had a deadline of April, the end of April, and I was sweating it there thinking we may not make it, because how Kickstarter works is if you do not raise your goal,
you don't get any
of the money that people pledge. And we exceeded the goal by, I think, a couple thousand dollars. I think we hit about $77,000. And not only that, we have confirmed that the It Gets Better Theater Project is the most funded theater project ever in the history of Kickstarter.
Wow.
And it was noted in a chart that ran in a story in the New York Times about Kickstarter and pointing out the levels of success of different projects in different categories. So in the theater category, It Gets Better, most successfully funded theater project in Kickstarter history.
That is so exciting. Now, give me the breakdown, because I haven't done, you know, I've participated in many Kickstarter projects, and I've certainly supported the It Gets Better with this one, but I've never organized one myself. I'm told that there's a lot of action in the last couple days.
There is.
And that it's very harrowing.
It is harrowing. For us, the action was more in the last week to 10 days.
Okay.
We didn't have to get down exactly to the wire to the last, you know, day or two like some companies do. I think a lot of our funding came in that last 7 to 10 days.
Okay.
But it was a lot of big pushes through the Gay Men's Chorus, through help of people like you with your media outreach for us, and also, you know, the It Gets Better campaign itself, so we have to give a big shout out to the folks at the
Absolutely.
It Gets Better campaign, because they and their email campaigns really helped us. But I'd say if I remember, with about 2 weeks to go, we were only about halfway there. We were around like $35,000, $37,000, and I was, you know, feeling this pit in my stomach going, oh my God, I cannot let this fail, because I, being Jimmy Nguyen, super Asian.
it's right there in the name.
Do not like to do things and not win at them.
Exactly.
So I was going to make this happen, and so we pushed really hard with a lot of help from the Gay Men's Chorus, and It Gets Better. And so in about the last 7 to 10 days, we brought in about, you know, over $35,000 in that last just week or so.
I will tell you, it's very difficult to do my monthly budget not knowing whether or not the money that I donated was going to go through. It's a little bit stressful.
Totally, totally. And our final sum was, I'm looking at our Kickstarter page now, $78,340 with 548 people backing
us. That's so fantastic. All right, but I will
give you a big shout out and thank you for helping us spread the word.
It was a treat. I was happy to have you guys on the show. I was happy to donate. But can we tip our hand a little and just say that we will have you and Liesl back to talk about developments as they become available?
Absolutely. We will have some things to report in the near future, and we would love to have you back, and we'll save you a seat for a special show somewhere.
So exciting. So exciting. Jimmy, as always, a pleasure having you on the show. I assume more articles are coming forthwith.
Absolutely. If you've got any great ideas, let me know. I'm always looking for great things from you or your listeners to maybe write about.
There you go. I was really inspired by, again, I took your article, the op-ed, and I ran with it, but I was just thinking about Tori Osborne, who's a candidate out there in California mm-hmm. for the California
right.
Assembly.
And today's election day on June, it's Tuesday, June 5th, as we're talking.
So what's the result? I guess it's early there still.
It's early, yes. I voted this morning, yeah. It's an interesting race because one of the other people in her assembly district now because of the redistricting is, you know, Betsy Butler, who is a member of the Board of Equality California's.
Yes, yes.
Which I served and is a wonderful, amazing straight ally of the LGBT community, huge supporter of ours. So it's interesting to have, you know, Tori Osborne, member of the LGBT community, having to face off against Betsy Butler.
Right, and so Tori referenced Harvey Milk in one of the quotes and said, Harvey Milk once said that electing our allies is great, but nobody can ever represent us as well as those who have already experienced the fires of discrimination. Very interesting race out there.
You just gave me goosebumps there.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm going to wait for the day when Ken Schneck for Congress is a sign. And
well, it's actually, I have the lawn sign set. It's Check Schneck. I already won public office last year here in Vermont, so I got to move up the scale to Congress.
Awesome.
But Check Schneck is
it's
the catchphrase of a generation.
It is indeed.
It's this generation's I Like Ike. I firmly believe that. I have just the right amount of delusion to be in Congress, so it'll happen.
Well, mine would just be, you know, win, Jimmy, win.
That's like a run, Forrest, run, though. That's more of a self motto. Mine is telling other people what to do.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Okay. You'll always win with Jimmy Wynn.
There you go. See, look how we worked that out right on the air. Jimmy, always a pleasure having you on the show.
Right.
We'll have you back.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Nobody can tell you there's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, as it hangs them up to see someone like you. But you've gotta make your own kind of music. Sing your own special song. Make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along. You're gonna be known.
All right, folks, that's all we have time for this week's show. So great to be back with you with a new episode, and we'll have another new one for you next week. Get out there. Go do some incredible things. And remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
The boy that's driving me mad is gone.